About 6-7 years ago, one of the great teachers of the Tibetan Buddhist lineage, His Holiness the Galwa Karmapa, must be longer than that now, he died in 1981. Anyway, a while ago, the Karmapa suggested that it would be good to start having a monastery in the West so that the Tibetan monastic tradition could be planted here like a little seed, and it would grow, and it would grow in a way that no one could quite predict because of new soil, new weather conditions. But that the seed should be planted so that the monastic tradition in Tibet.
That's what it was. Right.
Sorry. Get to hear my own talk. So that the wisdom of the monastic tradition wouldn't be lost. And this, he was particularly thinking of and the form that had gone to Tibet, but basically it's very similar in all the Buddhist traditions. But the thing that was so interesting was that my personal teacher, Chogyam Trungpa, suggested that one of our monks start looking for a place. But what they all said at that point, when we really became interested and we wanted to establish a monastery, was that they had no idea how we should do it. Because in Tibet, people had gone to the monasteries, they still do in the in Nepal and Ladakh and places like that. They go as children, and they sort of grow up in the monasteries. And so there's no tradition of grown-up people entering into the monastery and being trained. So it was a sort of we found ourselves in a frightening and delightful situation, which was to try to establish something that had no, which none of the elders could give us much guidance on how to do. In fact, they said they were quite puzzled by how to make this transition, and they would just see how we did, and then according to how we did, they might start establishing more places. So since 1984, we've been establishing this small place in Nova Scotia called Gompo Abbey. We have men and women there together, and really the reason for that was because when we started we had one monk and one nun, and it seemed a little silly to start two places. One for me and one for the monk. So that's somewhat how it came about, but with the approval of our teacher. Now, we have a lot of wonderful teachings, and we have a strong tradition of meditation practice, and we knew that this was the basis of our life there together. We also live by precept, so we knew that restriction, such as Achan Sumedho was talking about, that that was somewhat the sense of it. So we always thought it was quite fitting that as you came to the dirt road right before Gompo Abbey, there's a sign there that says, "No exit." And that always seemed like the perfect introduction to going to the monastery. Because when you're at the monastery, there is no kind of entertainment. There is just no way to escape from one's own mind. And this is, in my opinion, where the joy comes from. But this is maybe not what you might conceive of as joy. Like, where does joy come from? It seems that what we're finding through our meditation practice and our studying and living together there as a community is that there's sort of two main ingredients of human existence which become extremely available to one in a monastery. And one is confusion, and the other is wisdom. And what we seem to be finding there is that these two things, confusion and wisdom, are what we come to know fully and completely in our everyday life. And when we talk about open mind, when we talk about open heart, it seems that the openness is to not just our wisdom mind, what we think of as enlightenment or being fully awake, but also open mind and open heart to our confusion, which is to say there's a combination of seeing how mixed up we are, how selfish we are, how jealous we are, seeing our tempers, seeing our resentments. All these things are very heightened in community. But on the other hand, seeing these things with a lot of gentleness and compassion, developing sympathy for ourselves just as we are, it becomes like developing sympathy and compassion for humanness altogether, for the human condition. And interestingly enough, the fundamental teachings of the Buddha are not to try to get rid of yourself, not to try to get rid of all of these qualities, but to come to know them with enormous clarity and gentleness of heart. Seeing them so clearly, rather than just saying, I'm a bad person to be feeling this jealousy, I'm a bad person to be feeling this resentment, but instead, some sense of coming to see these things. The result of this traditionally is called nausea. What's actually said traditionally is that it's called nausea with samsara. But basically, the samsara, and also we talk about, well, in Buddhism, you think that this sense of ego or clinging to oneself gets a lot of bad press. And the basic notion you would think that joy would come from getting rid of all of this stuff. But there's so much aggression, fundamental aggression and fundamental unfriendliness in approaching the spiritual journey as one of getting rid of all the messy stuff. So instead of that, the idea is, how do you find true joy through in the face of human beings being as they are? And what we're finding is that living in a situation where there are no exits, no ways to get away, which is to say we have no entertainment there, we're celibate, we don't drink alcohol, and all the various ways, no smoking, cigarettes. So the ways that we usually escape are somewhat limited to just how we run away in our mind. And also the ways in which we recreate ourselves, the ways in which we cling to our sense of being a separate, secure kind of person. That's also another really good way of trying to shut down and close off. So there, all of that, as you might say, in a kind of a general and a gentle and compassionate way, all those things are somewhat under attack or by the fact that you're meditating a lot, you're studying teachings a lot, we communicate with each other a lot about these things. And there's some sense of just continually being nailed. So I think that monastery is somewhat like living in a house of mirrors, or continually like as if you were continually getting a video replay of yourself. So in some sense, the monastic life is simplifying everything. We talk a lot as a group about what are we doing here. not out of a sense of discouragement of why we're there, because in fact there's so much joy in being there, but we continually are contemplating our life, and we discuss it a lot together. We have formal sort of contemplative discussions at least twice a month, and actually much more frequently than that, around the table, eating meals and so forth. But one of the key issues seems to be this whole one of how this simplification, what is that all about? The fact that everything is simplified, which could be epitomized by that sign, no exit. In some sense, when I'm asked why I became a nun, I quite honestly often will say it was because I was too thick to do it as a layperson. Just too much alternatives, too much confusion, too much going on, and that I always felt distracted. And therefore, I was very, very magnetized to monastic life because of the fact that the major distractions of everyday life are removed. So in some sense, it's simplifying. It's definitely simplifying. Just living by precepts is simplifying things enormously. There's some sense of clarity, seeing what you do and why you do it. Some sense of everything being very, as I say, like a house of mirrors. This simplicity, though, I think a lot of people who want to become monks and nuns, they interpret the simplicity as some kind of sense of free of conflict, some sense of a peacefulness and harmony, which has no rough edges, where you go there and everyone is kind and nice, and people never raise their voice. Everyone pitches in, and it's just this swell place where there's no messiness at all. Wrong. It is, I do think that it's simpler in terms of spiritual journey. It's a simpler path than as a layperson, because I think as a layperson actually it is much harder, in the sense that 9-to-5 job, financial responsibilities, hard to find time to do intensive meditation, squeezing study of Buddhism into evening classes and this kind of thing. Whereas in the monastic life, the whole thing is a support for meditation and study. And the distractions are not there, in the sense of television and drinking alcohol and sexuality and this kind of thing. But what isn't often thought about by people who have a romantic notions, what isn't thought about is that this simplicity is actually murder. In the sense that what that means is that there you are with your own confusion and your own wisdom, and there's no way to get away from it. So basically in the monastery, and with a lot of meditation and the Vajrayana practices that we also do in this monastery, since Chogyam Trungpa is a teacher of Vajrayana, they tend, in some sense, to churn things up. They even talk in Vajrayana of heightening neurosis. Can you imagine that? I always say, though, you don't really need the practices. Life tends to do that quite nicely by itself. But the idea here being not of everybody acting out their confusion. And if you have a bad temper, the idea isn't... when that becomes heightened, that you feel free to just yell at everyone and throw things. But the idea also isn't that you repress it and that you just push it under. What happens is something that's in between acting out and repression, something that's in the middle. Talk about the middle way all the time in Buddhism, but we find at Gampo Abbey that we're just continually nailed, just right in that place. Precepts, for instance, you know, it isn't that you're that it's considered a sin or that you should feel guilty because you feel aggression. But you get caught in this very interesting place, which is encouraged by the restrictions of the monastery and by the meditation practice itself. You continually find yourself in a place where you, where the anger arises, if that happens to be your main sense of obstacle, or whatever it might be. Let's just talk about anger as an example. The anger arises, and then there's some sense of looking at that, wanting to know that anger, wanting to become like the world's greatest expert on anger. And it's to understand with tremendous heart anger altogether. And the only way to really understand it is to neither act it out nor to repress it. And so you, so in some sense, it's a very painful life. Always being, again and again, finding oneself with one's unresolved issues dramatically displayed to oneself and others. And wishing, basically, that you could just go off somewhere and be alone and not have to be seen by yourself or others. But instead of that, one finds oneself seeing so clearly, and one remembers again and again that the teachings are to see clearly, but with enormous good-heartedness, with a sense of loving-kindness for oneself. So the monastic life has a lot to do with this. I suppose you could say it's something about that this is your whole life, and your whole path is to see clearly with gentleness your own humanness. From that, what I am finding more and more is that without this, I don't think there's any genuine compassion possible, that you could really understand the sufferings of others or why other people do what they do, why there's violence in the world, why there's corruption and misery in the world. It comes, I think, from this kind of a real clear seeing with gentleness that's so heightened in monastic situation. So those of us that are there, we do our best to dissuade people from having romantic notions about coming to a place where the life is just going to be sweet and easy, love and light. And so instead it becomes a kind of encouragement to connect with your basic fundamental sanity and goodness that's there. And that's why I think it is a path of joy. The whole fact that the whole tradition of monasticism is just creating this framework where your whole life's work becomes one of connecting with your fundamental basic goodness and sanity. But it isn't found by just trying to push your negative qualities under the rug and pretend that you're already, since I'm already perfect, here's this whole group of already perfect people who come together and put on funny clothes to show everybody else how good they are. Instead of that, I think Thich Nhat Hanh says something about it. Monasteries are often places where a lot of people who are kind of misfits can't get on anywhere else. They end up coming to the monastery. Or spiritual discipline altogether. Probably we're a whole room full here of confused people. But you start where you are, and you realize that that is a good place to start, and nothing to be embarrassed about. And you start where you are, and you begin to realize that these two things, your confusion and your wisdom, this is your wealth. And that it isn't just about just connecting with wisdom. It's also about the humbling effect that seeing your confusion has on you. There's something so balancing about the fact that you're continually inspired, you have insights, and your world does open up. That is balanced with the fact that you continually see your limitations and how you shut down and how you aren't so kind and how you do have selfishness or whatever your case history may be. So one opens your world up and the other humbles you tremendously. And I think there's something about this balance of neither acting out nor repressing and realizing that both your confusion and your inspiration are your wealth and your path and your and the source of joy. To me, this is what being at this place for the last 6 years has been about. And we spend our life there exploring how to increasingly be able to communicate with each other. We have a kind of ideal, which we aren't too romantic about. It's an ideal that we contemplate a lot, but that is the ideal of enlightened society, because we feel a sort of impassioned about the fact that if we can't do it there, 15 to the most 40 people in this kind of rarefied, simplified situation where everything is pared down and there's total support for this kind of contemplation and exploration, if we can't communicate with each other, if we can't figure out how to work with our irritations and our resentments, if we can't do it there, how can we criticize the governments of countries? How can we criticize world leaders or politicians or anybody? So it's something of a microcosm with the hope that what we can learn there at a very personal, individual level could be a model for how there can be enlightened society altogether, which is to say, how to create situations, institutions, starting from monasteries to whatever it might take, that actually help people to connect with their awakened heart and their awakened minds. What does it take to inspire us, to open us, so that we connect with our fundamental sanity and goodness, rather than whole societies which are always supporting our insanity and our selfishness? So, I may I ask for a few questions? There's
sure.
10 more minutes.
Yeah, go ahead.
So I'd like to open it up just for a few questions if people want to ask them, and then we have about 6 minutes, and then we can break into the discussion groups. But, yes.
Yes, I really appreciate what you're saying. It almost sounds like you have some form of psychotherapy taking place in the monastery, maybe in groups or individual work or how that is done. And I'm wondering if you would view it that way or regard it that way. Is that part of your process, either formally or informally?
Well, that's a very interesting question, you know. In some sense, it does have a bit of that quality, although that was never our intention, and none of us are trained that way. I think it's a lot like, it's cultivating human bravery, which I think therapy at its best is, because it takes that kind of a dignity and bravery to really look in the mirror. But I think what is the added ingredient of a Buddhist monastery, just speaking from my own experience of this, which is quite limited, is all the emphasis on what in sort of highfalutin language is called egolessness or no self. the whole idea of unmasking in the Buddhist sense of clear seeing is to actually step out more and more into unknown territory. And which is to say, at an experiential level, I think you could say that the everyday practice is opening to other people and the situation you find yourself in, which includes opening to your emotions. But the key point is not centralizing into yourself. And actually, I feel that therapy needs to really be balanced by this, because otherwise therapy becomes a way of getting a kind of a sense of getting it all together, finally feeling completely good about myself. I'm going to finally have some kind of sense of ultimate security where, you know, I really can always ride with the punches and nothing throws me. And I would say that that's a sort of denying the first noble truth, and that there's much more truth in therapy and meditation working together, in the sense of becoming much more daring, and that it doesn't have to do with pleasure or pain, or whether your life feels happy or sad. It's much more interesting and vast than that. So the meditation part and our whole practice and our contemplation has a lot to do with stepping out into uncharted areas, which I suppose is one way of talking about the discovery of egolessness. It is a gentle and nurturing environment on the one hand, but on the other hand, people... It's so stark. So, is it easy or is it hard? It's hard to say. Yes?
How would you compare your monastery to the more traditional monasteries?
Such as the traditional Tibetan monasteries, in our case? Well... We actually value tradition a lot there. We have a very strong, you know, every day has a sameness to it in terms of sounds wake you up in the morning, and then the next sound you go to the meditation hall, and there's a whole system of sounds and bells and the meditation itself and all of that, which when I go to Eastern monasteries, something feels so much the same. And I think it's this magic that Ajahn Sumedho was talking about. There's something in this monastic situation that's like a time capsule for, it's like a vehicle for containing that particular sense of connecting with what does not die, sense of timelessness and limitlessness. So in some sense, the essence feels just the same. But definitely the outer manifestation is very different. I mean, we're men and women there together. We just talk a different language, and our mind, our relative mindset is so completely different. So maybe the main thing to say about what's different is it's not ethnic. I don't know, I don't think there's any other way to say it. It just isn't ethnic. That's why I think it has a sort of ring of therapy in a sense, although that wasn't the idea, but I think that's because Western people tend to look at growing up and waking up, maybe in those terms.
Especially in California.
Especially in California. Well, maybe especially in North America, and then especially on the west coasts of North America. So that's actually the time, as I...
So what we'd like to do now, and these 2 days are really meant to be informal rather than having a lot of talk just given to you, is to make a place for dialogue and questions. So after every time people speak, we'll have discussion groups. We divide this group, there's about 100 of us, into 5 groups of 20. One in that corner by the table, a second in the middle, where this rug is, and up front here, a third in that corner, and two along the back there. If you would do that, then we'll arrange ourselves and come, and two of us will join each group.
So all inside this tent?
I think, what do you think? Should we go outside? Is it going to be too much words in here?
I think we could go out.
All right.
It's going to be awful noisy.
It may be too noisy. Those who would like, then let's have two groups outside. Let's try that. Take chairs, probably, or whatever you'd be comfortable sitting on. The ground is a bit wet. Let there be two groups outside the tent, and then three in here. And then, among us.
Yourself.
My name is Humble Shun.
You speak Maori.
My name is Humble Shun. And I'm from. My name is Humble Shun. And I'm from Gold Mountain Monastery in San Francisco. And also associated with the City of 10,000 Buddhas in Talmadge. Mendocino County, and one of our major jobs is doing translation of the Chinese scriptures into English, and we have a very international community at the City of 10,000 Buddhas in Mendocino County. We have monastics from many, many countries, some Western countries, a lot of Asian countries, and we have a lot of traditionally ordained bhikshus and bhikshunis like myself who are also from the United States.
I'm Yanisara, and I've been staying at the Kampulu Kaba'ai Monastery. It's a Burmese monastery near Santa Cruz. But basically, I feel more aligned with monasteries I stayed in Southeast Asia, Burma and Sri Lanka. I've been in this country to just see if it'll work. Being here it's like an experiment for me. And I feel that as long as there's support and it feels like that there's that I'm not just vegetating while I'm in this country, that I'll continue. Yeah. So you hear many things in Asia from other Western monks that I think Ajahn Sumedho touched on it, that it just won't work. So I really wanted to see what would happen. This also is an experiment for me to be in this group. So, what happens.
So maybe we'll just open it up for questions, and you can direct your questions to any one of the three of us, and then we may have some interesting different takes on your questions. So I'm sure we will, in fact.
I have a question for you, and it bothered me especially. I was so mental, I thought to myself, what are the I'm going to do? Is there any balancing process going on, or is there manual labor to balance all this mental operation going on, or all the psychotherapy or whatever goes on, that you don't constantly go through this mental mechanism without some type of a balance? And I thought to myself, there's something wrong with this monastery.
Well, I didn't talk about it, but we actually do a lot of work. We're building the monastery. So everything from construction to just the ongoing upkeep of a place, you know, in terms of housekeeping. And we, in our tradition, we also cook and we take part in all the different parts. So we work hard, actually. So what we've done is, in fact, in the beginning, we worked so hard that we weren't sure that we'd have time for meditation. So we divided the year in these initial stages where there's still so much initial construction and things to do. We divided the year into four parts, two parts where the emphasis is on working, and we do a lot of work. That's when all the messy, chainsaws and noisy, dusty stuff goes on, and two periods of the year where we don't do any work at all except for just the maintenance of the place. So we sort of have a more contemplative and meditative winter, and then the summer is very active and energetic, and it sort of balances itself like that. So we do a lot of other stuff. Otherwise, we'd go crazy.
No, it just sort of disturbed me because I said there had to be a balancing process going on to alleviate some of the mental tension. So you have a period of chanting out.
Right.
The reason I brought this up because you said you were doing an experiential or experiential type of process. And, I thought maybe this was the middle was the most paramount.
Well, what I'd say in our situation, it might be interesting to hear in the other situations, but I think since we already came there with meditation practices and course of study and so forth, I think the thing that's been the most interesting has been that it's been the interpersonal relationships, in other words, the sense of getting on with one another, that has had the most influence on how we're developing. So a lot of it is how to live a life that's not too tight and not too loose, how to live a life which is conducive to human sanity, you know, and awakening. And so you find, yeah, it's always balancing, balancing, balancing all the time. What balances what, you know? But so that you get people who feel there's too much work, and then people who feel there's too much solitude, and too much, some people think it's too noisy, and some people think it's too quiet. And so since people are a lot of individuals, it's just like human society in general. And so how to balance so that there's some sense of support for the spiritual journey there. So all these things are always being balanced.
Yeah, I'm really curious how you balance that. Do you do trade-offs? I mean, in other words, I'm very interested in the monastic realm and how people work out what I think are some really basic questions and those kinds of things. It's just, I see it also as an organizational question in a larger society situation. How do you do this stuff? How do you actually pragmatically work out that? So, like the noise, or, I mean, that's a simple thing. I'm really more interested actually in harder stuff.
Like what?
Like power issues. Who runs the show? Whose ego gets out there first and sets an agenda? And then how does everybody work around that?
Right. Well, this actually becomes path. This is what the whole thing is about, is just these kinds of issues. How do you work with the normal issues that people have to somehow go beyond the sense of being caught in petty issues? I mean, how do you use what you have to really wake up and not just be stuck, you know, in the resentment mind or you know, in other words, you don't want to do the whole thing at the level of you don't want to do the whole thing out of samsaric mind. How do you actually use all these teachings and these practices to have a healthy society? That really becomes the whole path. So it's very much a work in process. But what we were given to work with is the mandala principle. This is very typical in Tibetan culture. Mandala principle means that somebody sits in the middle, and then they empower people around them to do what they should do, and those people empower the people around them to do what they should do. So it sort of goes out from the center. But the basic underlying notion of the mandala principle is that everybody knows that it's a play, and that you're just playing your role in the play. So whether you're sitting in the center or whether you're seemingly much further out on the fringe of the mandala, everybody does their role with this sense of theater. I don't know how else to say it. So my role was to sit in the middle there.
Right.
And so I did a pretty terrible job of it. I shouldn't say I'm doing such a good job now, but I would say I've learned a lot about the spiritual journey in the process. And the first thing I learned was that I just went about it in the usual samsaric way, which was that I'm the leader and you do what I say, so to speak. I mean, I said that with a smile and everything seemed, I didn't quite, but basically I wanted it to go my way, for right down to what kind of chairs we bought, you know, I wanted it to go my way. And so, but on the other hand, I was very committed, more committed to waking up than to having it my way. And so that, to me, is the friction that produces spiritual growth, is that you're more committed to waking up than having it work out, and yet you're always coming up against just the same problems that everyone comes up against, and what to do. Well, I practice listening. That's, I think... this whole thing I talked about how things humble you, is a very humbling experience. And I just listen a lot. And what I've found is that in our situation, what works is if I sit very still, and when I think of me, I think of like whoever sits there in the middle. I don't think of it just like me, but I'm the one who's learning from it now. That person should sit very still and not do a lot, so that that person, everyone can come to for spiritual advice. And you're not all messed up, mixed up in the arguments about what's right and wrong. But on the other hand, so there is somebody who represents spiritual authority, even if it's role-playing, you know. Then I found the next most important thing is that I really let go of having to have it my way and empower everyone around me. So once I say, I want you to be in charge of all the education here, and I want you to be in charge of all the practice, and I want you to be in charge of the aesthetics of the place and so forth, I have to really let them be in charge. And then, so it's like, and then they're encouraged to empower the people under them, and that's the whole idea of empowering everyone seems very important. And but I find that that takes a lot of courage, because it really does mean letting go. So somewhat this is how we work, how to discover egolessness at practical level.
There's two experiences that I've had. One is in Zen training, studying with Joshu Sasaki Roshi for some time, in which, as traditional, I guess, in most Zen monasteries, that the roles, as you say, people will take on a role for the time, are rotated. And mm-hmm. So two very important roles in the Zen community, in his community, was the jikijitsu, who kind of kept the discipline in the hall, and whether it was hitting people with the stick who were asleep, although that's really a kind of a metaphor for it. But making sure that people were on time, that everyone was silent, that was one important role. And there was a role of the, and that was kind of seen as a father role. There was a much more nurturing role of the person who was the mother for that group. Might be a man or a woman, it didn't matter. If you had needs, if you had difficulties, you could go and they would always take care of you and provide what you needed. And you were assigned by the abbot or the Zen master to have that role for a year or two. And then often he would switch it all around and say, all right, you were the person who was keeping the discipline, the bad guy, now you become the mother. And your job is to let go of that role and be as nurturing as you can. And in doing so, it began to train people to see to not possess our roles as ourselves, but to really learn how to let go and move with different situations. And there was some of that in the forest monastery, in that people would be assigned to be abbots of small monasteries or in charge of certain projects, and then sometime later they'd fulfill a different role.
I have a question that follows on the heels of yours. Maybe it has to do more with Western society than Eastern, but it has to do with despotism and abuse of power. And I'm interested in the three of you, because I was in a community, although we didn't live together, we practiced together, and the person, it seems like there's a tremendous responsibility for the person at the center to know their limitations. And in this structure that I was in, it was all top down, bottom up, but there was no lateral discussion allowed. It was part of practice. It was seen as part of Buddhist Tibetan practice not to talk to each other, only to relate to this woman.
And reflection, something. And unfortunately, there were certain things that she had in the way of negative attributes that got strengthened along with the positive attributes. And I've seen the same thing in midwives who practice in a solitary way, that, or any health practitioner, that if they don't have or aren't working in a tradition where there's peer possibility of peer criticism, then their best attributes get better and their worst get worser.
Right.
And,
yeah, that's right.
So
that's true.
I wonder how one does that in a monastic life, because I'm interested in creating community in normal everyday life. And I see the same thing with how are things in the people most least likely to recognize their own limitations are the ones who are most likely to abuse the power. And if there's no precepts or structure in which everything is questioned, it doesn't seem like it would have to happen in a monastery or a tradition where there wasn't so much ego-centeredness, but in the rest, I just have real questions. Because I submitted in the name of devotion to the practice, and then was told that the only way to through was submission to the teacher, because she held the practice. And so when I had questions about the nature of the structure, I was kicked out and told that I wasn't, I was not able to submit. And I'm easily devotional, so it took me a long time to figure out there was an abuse of power. And in her situation, she had to wipe out, really hurt you before she could pass on the teaching. So there was a real painful, unkind thing going on. It took me years to get it, because I was devoted. So I guess I have a question about abuse of power.
I'm the one, right? I'm the one. So, but it wasn't just me sitting in the middle. It was just in general this becomes an issue. So again, I want to emphasize that I think one of the powerful things about the monastery is you take these usual samsaric situations and they become your path. How to use this usual stuff to wake up. I mean, to me, that's what distinguishes it just from these same problems in a job, at work, or you know, in a school or something, is this heartfelt, earnest feeling on the part of everybody, no matter where they're sitting in the mandala, to want to not be fettered by a petty mind, you know. So how to open it up in the view of the fact that things are continually triggering off your unresolved issues. You know, whether they be power or you may be, your issue may be that you're always the one who's intimidated, the victim, you know. So I would say the three things that we work with in this regard are, we do a lot of meditation because that opens the mind. We use study as a way of talking to each other in a dharmic way. In other words, the content is a class and someone gives a talk, but then we bring all our life issues into the class in terms of the Dharma. So the merging of those things, sometimes that we've had the most liberating kind of discussions because people begin to get insight into their own process by just talking about the teachings. And the third is that we have regular meetings where we just air things and talk to each other, and people are free to express anything. Give me the final word, because we found that works better than democracy. But on the other hand, I learned from Brother David, actually, and from Father Thomas Keating, something from Christian monasticism, which is that you don't make any important decisions without sitting with everyone and hearing everybody. So we sit in a circle and everyone expresses what they feel about it. And then they all say, okay, you make the decision based on all of this, and then I just try to do my best. And then they know, at least, if the opinion doesn't agree with them, they know at least it isn't just me, my opinion, that I'm trying to listen to what the real needs are of everybody and do my best. And so that cuts through a lot of that feeling of not being heard. That's what we found was the main thing, is if you feel you're not being heard, that's where the frustration comes from. there's no way to be heard seems to be a not a good, not a healthy situation. So. Do anyone else want to talk about this?
I think my experience is quite different from, say, famous. I belong to a community. We already have a very, very large monastic community. At the City of 10,000 Buddhas, we have over 100 monks and nuns. We're dealing with people from a lot of different cultures. And so our scope is not just limited to America. In fact, I myself speak Chinese in my normal day more than I speak English. And so we're dealing with, you know, in our community, we might have, let's say, a nun who's in her 80s, who's totally illiterate. We might have someone who's has a doctorate from Berkeley. So we have a very, very diverse community. And altogether at the city, there's several hundred people living there, over 100 monks and nuns. So we also have the interrelationship with the monastic community and the lay community. And basically, we resolve issues just through group meetings. I guess naturally, there's natural leaders who have experience, but there's no one who dominates. So we have, for example, American Bhikshunis who have been Bhikshunis for 20 years, and we have a lot of American monks who have been monks for 15 or so years. And then we have a lot of older Asian people who have been monastics for a long time too, even from China, Taiwan, Hong Kong. And just through these meetings, there's natural leaders that evolve, and issues just have to be resolved as a group, as a consensus. It's very interesting for me to participate in something like this, because I never have thought in terms of just purely this Caucasian American community. I'm dealing a lot with Chinese Americans, and I think that's an interesting issue. What ultimately is an American monastic community? And the other day I was talking with a lawyer, a Chinese person, and he spoke English very fluently. And I asked him, "Are you born in America?" And he goes, "I'm fifth generation." And I thought, "Gee, I'm only second generation American." So. Anyway, the scope of our organization is more international. We do a lot of traveling. We have branch monasteries in Asian countries too. But we have a very large Western group within the whole monastic community. We have about 30 Western monks and nuns.
But you solve issues through consensus. That's mostly what we do also. But sometimes they want a yes or no from somebody. So that's...
people who are a designated physician, as being the leader, just sort of naturally evolves.
Excuse me, may I ask, is that also on a spiritual level as well?
On a spiritual level, we have our teachers from China. He's in his late 70s. His name is Master Hua. He's been a monk for over 50 years. And he's looked up as the spiritual advisor. If it's something of importance for people who are rather experienced, they can go to him for spiritual advice.
From the very beginning in Buddhist... Buddhist tradition, reading the earliest texts that you can find, there was a strong emphasis on consensus for decision making, and some sense of representative democracy. That is, a council of elders or people who had committed themselves. It wasn't just you could walk in the door and say, "I think you should paint it green now," but a council of elders of people who had committed their lives to that would meet, and then out of them, as you suggest. There would either by election or by acclaim, there would arise leaders who were obviously both acknowledged and respected among the group, who would take that role, but in conjunction with the Council of Elders, and it's been some balance of that. It's gotten out of balance, obviously, in many specific communities, but the spirit of that has been there from the very beginning.
I live with the Once Mars and Just as Joshua. If I may, I'd like to say something about how we
We have a group of people who are called staff who are left in charge of the meditation hall, which is what John's job is. And they make a lot of decisions by consensus, but the general community doesn't really make many decisions by consensus at all. Unless it's some kind of really major call.
It's getting stronger.
Last year we had a situation where we had a lot of lay workers come in and live at Hasmara and build buildings for us. So that was a very kind of input situation, although we had nothing to do with what the final decision was going to be about whether the buildings came or not. But we had a lot of group discussions about it. And then the staff has a lot of discussion. And then there's another group of people who decide on the practice issues at Hasmara about what the patterns are going to be. We don't follow a traditional structure of Soto Zen in Japan, but there are nuances within as the years go by and how things change. So it's kind of a combination of various things that go on. And also I think because the positions change every 3 months and every year, depending on what your job is, you tend to have a more of a way of relating to each other as equals rather than a hierarchy. So I think that keeps that kind of situation from arising where you sort of blindly follow people. I think it's Zen Center at San Francisco Zen Center because we've had a lot of kind of problems with that kind of thing now. It's sort of
we do a lot of study, and we also have meditation intensives that people come to. I'd say the main way we work with it is that the older students lead the discussions and lead the meditations and so forth. However, we also have quite a lot of respect for bringing people along through putting them in positions of leadership. Trungpa Rinpoche worked with us that way. It's like there's so much criticism for authority, but just put the authority for one day, and it's quite a humbling experience, and you learn a lot from it. And so we do work with that too. But obviously, the students that are isn't always the years that you've spent, but there's certain students that seem to have more maturity and seem to be more grown up in the Dharma and who seem to have a more genuine accessibility to generosity and kindness and these things. So it's kind of natural hierarchy, I would say, in that way of looking. So naturally you go to those people to ask when you're having a hard time and you can't figure out what to do, you ask them. But the only formal way that exists is in this mandala and the teaching of classes and running the meditation programs. And yes. Oh, yes. Yeah. We're very small, so we all do everything. I mean, it doesn't matter what your role, official title is. Everybody cooks and washes dishes and cleans the place and everything like that. So we do work together.
In the Forest Monastery, it was much that way, that with 80 or 100 monks, still people did most everything together. We ate together, obviously those kind of functions, but if there was a building project, the abbot would come out and help do that. Or if there was a festival day to receive many lay people, everyone would do it together, and so there was enough together work that you had a lot of association between new students and those who had been there the very longest. And that made a wonderful feel if you were having some difficult job to do, that the abbot or some of the other senior monks were there with you. It really gave a sense of that being practice and the spirit of the community.
If you've been there 3 years, you're a senior student. You're a fairly transient population. So I think one of the things that's a problem for us is that we have to take on jobs that maybe we are capable of doing on an efficiency level, but not necessarily on a practice level. And that's kind of an ongoing thing that happens at Tassajara. It's a problem there in the community. So I'm curious, do you have those kind of problems of that? So
can you give an example? Can you give an everyday example of that?
Well, I'll give you an everyday example.
Okay.
I'm an ordained pastor,
and I'm the CEO of Tassajara, which means I run the meditation
process.
That's the job that I think I'm much better done by someone who's been practicing many more years than I have.
I think maybe we take a little bit different approach, though, which is, I say, you know, trial by fire, or whatever, there's more concern for each person developing themselves. And so, one, I think it's an excellent way to develop yourself is to be suddenly made the Eno. You know, doesn't it humble you tremendously? And and on the other hand, you realize it's sometimes a certain confidence also comes from it. You see your wisdom and you see your confusion. And so I think, especially with smaller communities, that's inevitably what happens. And I don't see that as a problem. I see that as actually quite good. And some people get this great longing for more realized people to be around, you know. But that has its own neurosis in it, needless to say, you know. That's this sort of dependency that you're always looking for the wiser person. And you do have to find the wisdom in your own mind and heart. And there's no question that people that have maybe are more in touch with their confusion and more in touch with their wisdom, those people inspire us and support us in our own journey. But I think ultimately, you know, being thrown back on yourself is very healthy. We have an abbot, Tibetan abbot, Trangu Rinpoche, and he comes once a year, and that's an interesting ingredient. He doesn't come enough for us to depend on him, but he comes enough to sort of keep things moving forward. Every time he comes, he just introduces something that we just kind of take this leap forward in our understanding. So we're grateful for him. Trungpa Rinpoche left us him as a gift, parting gift.
I'm constantly conflicted about Buddhism in the world, so to speak. At the present time, I live in a Zen center, but I also work full 40 hours a week. So I'm divided, but my question is, when I do become a full-time resident, do I devote all my time there? I've been in social action things, and I keep seeing there's so many things, problems to be worked on that I could spend some time. I'm wondering if it's in this period of Buddhism where we need to develop centers and devote our time to that, and whereas in the earlier times in South Asia and places like that, where it was more part of the community, is that a difference right now? I just think, well, do I withdraw? It seems to me kind of like a withdrawing from the world, from the problems of the world, from the need, homelessness, all these things. And this is right now, it's my point.
I think that differs a lot from center to center and group to group, what the basic thing is. What do you have anything to say about that?
Well, I think it's a great confusion of where our place, what our place lies in the monastery. How do we function? Are we really separate from everything else, or are we somehow integrate? Is there any such thing as separation? All these things are confusions in the mind about this. And I think from the beginning, there needs to be faith in what you're doing as a benefit for all beings. Not that I'm benefiting myself only. And so that sort of grows in time. And as wisdom starts to develop, then this naturally flows to others around you, and it affects. It depends on who you are, what you know, what your capacity is. If Dalai Lama affects many thousand people, but other people may also have wisdom, but they only affect the immediate community. I think it's a natural process. When wisdom arises, then it's a product of your practice, what your practice has been. It isn't that something you're forcing, I have to help all beings, I have to get out there and do it, you know. But it's something that you can't avoid. It flows like a song from your voice. You know, it's just it's something shared, and it's not something like you're suddenly now. Oh, I'm enlightened to tell everybody about it. This is a wrong impression. You're probably not enlightened if you really believe that. It's just it's like somebody calls you and say, what do you believe? They're inspired by you. How you look and how you talk inspires others, right? They want to know. And so it isn't something your ego is coming across and say, I have to teach these people. I have to help all beings. That's why I look at this path. And so, you know, if you let go of these needs of, what about all the suffering people? What do I do about that? If you let go of that, then it just arises when you have the capability of dealing with it. So many people don't have any capabilities at all, but they're out there, and they make lots of mistakes, and sometimes more pain arises because of that. If they have the wisdom to deal with it, then it's a whole different kind of... It's a different kind of patch. It's something, you know, that many masters were so amazed by some of the ways they deal with situations, with people's problems or whatever. It's totally what you wouldn't think about dealing with. But it seems right, and it really helps. But it may not be conventional. And that's where the wisdom, what happens in the wisdom is there.
One of the...
I've never really wanted to be a teacher because of this. You know, I never felt like, even though I had things to say and felt like, gee, I should help people, there's something that holds me in a kind of a position of like a fruit on a tree. When the fruit is ready, who can say, now it's time to pick it? It falls of its own.
One of the beautiful things about Buddhist tradition is that there's an honoring of the cycles of life. And so there are monasteries, and there are times for retreat and inward practice, and then there are also many other expressions of practice. And when I lived in the Ajahn Chah's forest monastery, it was during the Vietnam War, and his main monastery is on the border of Cambodia and Laos. So at night you'd see the flash from the bombs from our air war. You'd hear the rumble and you'd watch the B-52s. And I had some friends who were in the Quaker peace movement in Vietnam who went to work during the war in villages. And they would come and say, how can you sit here and meditate when all this is so nearby? But at the same time, what that monastery was a place that represented thousands of years of human goodness. And even though people were insane around it, because war does that, it was a place that you could go and lose your wallet or something of value and someone would simply pick it up and give it back to you. And or it was a place that you could come with your great sorrows and someone would greet you with compassion and as much generosity as they could. And it was like a living library, a living jewel of some other possibility for human society. And so one couldn't say, well, that monastery, all the monks should have gone into Vietnam and worked in the villages. It was another expression of the Dharma, and both of those are valued. Then the difficulty is to figure out what rhythm you're in your own life.
We don't have a one theory about it, and it tends that there seems to be room for people to follow their inclinations. So one of our main monks is very interested in study and not in kind of engaging in things. And he works on trying to balance himself that way. Then we have another one of the main monks is very interested in engaging. He has a literacy class in the local town where we live because there's a lot of people there that are illiterate, and he's teaching them and he wants to work with that. And then he balances himself with trying to have more retreat time and so forth. So in other words, people can follow their inclinations, and then they also try to watch for what part of their inclination is neurosis and what part is wisdom, and it's always all mixed up. So I think it's nice if it's possible to not have a strict guideline on that, but allow the flexibility, because that makes for a healthy community too. If people's in, there's lots of different interests and they can be followed. So you might want to go out and someone else might want to stay in and whatever.
Ajahn Chah, as a teacher, used to generally assign people in the opposite direction of their interests. So
yeah,
if you really love solitude, he'd send you to Bangkok to the monastery on the highway.
That's a good
one,
yes.
And if you loved people and were very gregarious, you'd end up in this godforsaken cave monastery outside a village of three people.
Right, that's a good one, yeah.
I have a question about Chogyam Trungpa. Did you actually spend time with him?
A lot of time with him, yes.
I don't know how to describe it. I feel a great deal of affinity with his writings. I mean, and I don't think there's anyone I've read that I thought had a broader range of wisdom. I mean, it just... and I had heard that he also drank a lot and that he liked excitement. And I was just... I think I have heard it from people I trusted, but I wanted, since you had spent time with him once, to know that human side of him, if you did know about it. And that may be why I feel an affinity for him.
Right. Well, Rinpoche was a very unconventional person, and he drank very heavily. It was probably the main cause of his death. And he was had many, many, many love affairs, and he was a wild person. Oh, no, not at all. He was a monk in his early life, but then he stopped being a monk. So he's very shocking to many people. But obviously to his students, there was something about that was magnetizing. And I was a student. So I would say that for me, especially being a celibate nun who never came close to living the style that Rinpoche lived, that the message was that... however you find yourself, whatever your tastes and appetites are, you're still a candidate for enlightenment. That there isn't some kind of ideal purity or something that you have to try to be living up to, but rather, more what I was saying, you can see yourself as you are, and how do you live with that, not acting out, but not repressing, but some sense of finding your wisdom and confusion as both being teacher for you. See, actually what the Vajrayana emphasizes is that your wisdom and your confusion are so interrelated that if you throw out one, the other gets thrown out too. So just to have this ideal of purity, which is always then, for Western people, seems to result in a lot of guilt about our so-called impurity, the approach is more to just see clearly, with compassion, how you are. And not act out, not repress, but... So Rinpoche was kind of, for me, I think, a model of that however you were a candidate for enlightenment. And he was a man I respected enormously. So.
Stand up. If I may have your attention for a moment, it's about 12:20 for the Theravada monks and nuns especially, they have to eat before 1 o'clock. So what we'd like to do now, it sounds like the discussions, there's plenty more to continue and there'll be time for that, is to have a lunch period for everyone to clear just this center area here and invite the monks and nuns to eat in this place. And the rest of you, invite you also to go and bring your food and to eat either inside the tent as you wish or outside.
Give me room through here.
You need a little room, also a little aisle here to come around.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.